grateful for this, you know.
Great to be here. Great to be home with all of you. I'm Rachel, for those of you who don't know me, and I'm living in Toronto right now, but this really is my home, so it's so great to be back here with so many familiar faces and people that I know. How many people were here last evening? Okay, most people were here last evening, and we heard what Paul said, and I think a lot of us know the experience that he described. We know what it's like to be in a conversation with someone, be it a friend, a child, a family member, and they ask you that question, you know, that question that makes you squirm. All these questions that we put up on the sheet last night. And we're not sure what to do. Our first instinct is just to panic, to make something up, or perhaps to get defensive and fight back, like Paul said last evening. And the real problem with those responses isn't just that they might make us look bad. The real problem with those responses is that they're surefire ways to end a conversation. And we think that conversations are really, really important. They're some of the most important things, actually, that we do as human beings, as people, as relational people. They're how we develop relationships. They're how we get to know each other. They're how we learn from each other. And they're some of the best ways that we have of sharing and communicating our faith with other people. And so when we have real and honest and ongoing conversations with people, we honor the people that we're speaking to. And we also honor the God that we're speaking about. Because we don't serve a God that just sits way out there somewhere and shouts instructions at us from afar. We serve a God that cares about what we have to say, that cares about how we think and how we feel, and that engages in real conversations with us. And any honest look at the Bible will communicate that. You can see, even throughout the Old Testament, God in conversation with Abraham and Moses, wrestling through issues, and God responding to the things that they have to say, and acting in response to them. You see a God who engages in real conversations. And so, if we're going to reflect that God to the people we're speaking with, we need to learn to have real conversations with other people. Apologetics is a word that often gets misunderstood because it very much resembles the word apologize. And perhaps you came here this weekend for a weekend of apologetics thinking that we were going to teach you how to apologize really well for being a Christian. We're not going to do that. But I think sometimes we all feel like maybe we should be doing that. Because a lot of people have gotten into conversations with Christians and they never want to do it ever again. They've had such bad experiences that they think that a conversation with a Christian is never going to be a real conversation. It's always going to look more like monologue than dialogue. It's always going to look a lot more like preaching than it is like a real give and take conversation. And so what we're going to talk about today is not ways to win a conversation, not ways to control the outcome of a conversation. We're going to talk about ways to stay in a conversation, how to keep it going so that real learning, mutual friendship and learning and relationship become possible, even in the face of some of those tough questions that make you squirm. So you're sitting in that cafe, and that question comes at you. What do you do? Of course, we can't answer every one of these questions in a fully satisfactory way for you. That's really not what this is about. But we do believe that there's a way to take away the threat that you sometimes feel when that question's asked. And we're going to talk about that today. Some ways to stay in the conversation, ways to remove the threat that you might initially feel when you're asked that tough question. First way to stay in the conversation is to look under the question. Most questions that are asked are not always what they appear. There may be many, many things lying under that question that need to be unpacked, that need to be pulled apart before you can really get at the heart of that question. The story Alice in Wonderland has this scene where Alice is trying to get through this door, and there's a footman there who's preventing her from getting in, and she's getting very frustrated, and she's saying, "How am I going to get in?" And he doesn't answer, and she says, "No, how am I to get in?" And the footman stops her and said, "No, are you to get in at all? That's the first question, you know." Because Alice wanted to know how to get in, but the footman was reminding her that the question how you get in is irrelevant if you're not actually going to get in at all. First, you need to answer the question, are you getting in? before the question how you get in makes any sense at all. So first questions first is what this is about. Look under the question. Sometimes you need to look under the question because there are assumptions, hidden assumptions under the question that someone's asking. We sometimes call these loaded questions or leading questions, and you see it all the time in courtroom dramas on TV, where the prosecutor comes up to the defendant and asks them a leading question, something like, please tell the court, when was it that you stopped robbing banks? When was it that you stopped robbing banks? Now, it's very difficult to answer a question like that directly without sort of implicating yourself in guilt to begin with. You might first have to stop and say, well, actually, I never stopped robbing banks because I never started robbing banks in the first place. There was an assumption under that question that this person had actually engaged in that practice. If they answer the question first without unpacking the assumption, then they've already admitted to guilt to begin with. And this is very, very common in questions that come at you about your faith. Here's a question. It was kind of brought up last night. And this is a really common question that we get asked. How can you be so arrogant? How can you be so arrogant as to say that Jesus is the only way to God? How many people have heard a question similar to that been asked to them before? Yeah, a lot of us have. That's a very loaded question, isn't it? There's a lot of assumptions lying under a question like that. Help me out. What do you think are some of the assumptions that are hiding under a question like that?
That we're being arrogant.
Yeah, to say Jesus is the only way to God is an arrogant thing to say. Yeah.
That it's really us who's saying that Jesus is the only way.
Yeah, that it's us who's making the claim that Jesus is the only way to God. In other words, Christians are just a club that wants to keep other people out, so they're saying our way is the only way and your way is wrong. Whereas, if you unpack that a little bit, who's actually making the claim? If it's Christ that's making the claim, the real question is the claim legitimate or not? Not, is it arrogant for Christians to reflect that in their belief? So very good. Any other assumption?
It says stating that one way to God is a bad thing as opposed to lots of ways to God, but that's an assumption and can't just be accepted.
Yeah, an assumption that somehow one way to God is a horrible claim to make as opposed to many ways to God or something like that.
Mm-hmm. There may be an honest concern about people in the world that never hear of Jesus.
Yeah, so this might be a question that's very deep to someone. Maybe it's someone, in fact, that they know who believes something different, and this person's concerned about that person. Maybe it's, yeah, they're concerned about people in other parts of the world who've never heard about God or who belong to another religion or another path to God, and it doesn't seem fair to them.
It makes them angry because it assaults their beliefs right away.
Yeah, it might be provoking an actual anger reaction in someone. When they hear you making a claim, maybe because they think you're calling them wrong. And so it's an initial defense response. Yeah. Anything else? Very good. Those are a whole bunch of assumptions. You've named 6 or 7 right away from just that one question that gets asked. And sometimes if you don't stop and maybe ask the person where this is coming from or go through some of those assumptions with them and say, well, wait a minute. Is it actually, you know, the case that it's like what you said, is it actually the case that it's arrogant to claim there's only one way to God? Well, what do you believe about this? And you'll find that every single person who holds any beliefs about anything at all excludes some other beliefs. Doesn't matter what worldview that person holds, they don't accept the truth of everything else that everyone else believes. And so they're really claiming that there's one right thing to believe too. But somehow they haven't thought about that in terms of their own belief, and they only first want to accuse it to your belief. So unpacking some of those assumptions is important, and we'll get into this a little bit more in depth afterwards. The other reason you want to look under the question is because there are experiences that underlie questions. Most of the deepest, most personal questions that we ask as people, they come out of our stories, our experiences, the lives we've lived, the people that we've met, the people we know. And if your answers to questions or our belief don't in some way resonate or ring true with someone's experience, they're not going to be very compelling. This becomes especially important with certain types of questions. For example, the question came up last night, and it's actually the most common question that we ever get asked in apologetic context, why does God allow so much suffering in the world? If you begin to answer a question like that without looking under the question first, it can do way, way more harm than it can ever do good. Why? Because there are so many experiences that underlie a question like that about suffering. Things that may have gone on in this person's own life. Things that may have gone on in the life of people they love. Perhaps it's just the overwhelming experience of looking around our world and realizing that there's children dying of horrible diseases every day and wars. And that can be a very overwhelming emotional experience. And so people ask questions out of their experiences. And if your first response to a question like that is to reason your five ways why it makes perfect sense that their life has been horrible, you can see what that's actually communicating to someone. Giving reasoned answers to rationalize away something like suffering without being sensitive to the experiences that it comes out of may sound very much like you're explaining why this person's suffering makes perfect sense in your worldview. How it has a place, how it's perfectly justified. And you can see why that might not be initially very compelling to someone who's had those kind of experiences. And lastly, language. If I were to walk up to the average person on the street in Sault Ste. Marie and said, Jesus died for your sins. You have to have faith and believe in Jesus in order to go to heaven someday. What do you think I would have communicated to a person on the street in Sault Ste. Marie? Sorry?
You're a sinner.
You're a sinner.
You're a bad person.
You're a bad person. Yeah, perhaps not even anything, because there are a lot of people, I don't know, maybe some people would know what that means, but there's a lot of people, especially where I live in Toronto, who would not have understood most of the words in that sentence at all. They don't know what sin means. They don't know who Jesus is. If they have heard of him, he's just a guy that lived a long time ago, what has nothing to do with me today. They don't know what heaven means. They don't know what faith means. They don't know how you can believe in have faith in someone that lived 2,000 years ago. I mean, nothing in that sentence would have communicated anything to a person who doesn't already have a background or a context to understand that kind of language. So language can get in the way if we don't unpack concepts, if we don't even understand those concepts well enough to be able to translate them for people who don't understand them. Sometimes this gets in the way of interacting from people with different worldviews. For example, very, very often, if we're speaking with people who are Muslim, they will ask us the question, almost inevitably, how can you say Jesus is the Son of God? How can you claim Jesus is the Son of God? This is a horribly offensive claim for a Muslim person. And it may initially seem like this is a theological difference that you need to debate out with this person. But actually, if you really think about it and understand where this person's coming from, it's really a problem of language, isn't it? Because what? Saying that Jesus is the Son of God, why do you think that might be really offensive to a Muslim person? Does anyone have any thoughts?
They don't believe that Jesus is God.
They don't believe that Jesus is God. That's true. But even just the language Son of God, what do you think that might communicate to someone?
Mm-hmm. Involved.
That there's procreation involved. Muslim people think that when Christians say Jesus is the Son of God, they mean God slept with a woman and had a baby, and that's Jesus. And that's the claim they think you're making about God. And as most of us, I think, would acknowledge, that isn't actually an offensive claim that would be problematic theologically, that God slept with a woman and had a baby. But really, it's not even a theological difference at all. It's actually a miscommunication about the concept of what a son means when you refer to God. And so we need to be really careful about the language we use and the concepts that the person we're speaking with understands. You know, if we're going to be salt and light in the world, well, we probably have to stop using words like salt and light unless we know that people understand what we mean by that. So the first way in the way to stay in the conversation was to look under the question. Second way I'm going to suggest is to walk around the question. What I mean by that, and I just illustrated with that last example, is that people come at questions from very different worldview perspectives. John gave that illustration last night with the lenses. How you see the world, what are your most basic fundamental assumptions about the universe, about God, about human beings, affect everything else you think and everything else you do in your life. You may not realize it, you may not make all those connections, but the fundamental things you believe will affect everything else. And so people that you're walking around with, people that you're interacting with, they come with those different lenses on, and they're looking at the question from a very different perspective. And so you have a choice to either stay on your side of looking at the question from one way and try shouting across until hoping that something you say gets across to the other person, or you can make the effort to walk around that question and stand where the other person's standing for a minute and try to understand the question from their perspective. Why is it they think the way they do? Why is it, what's that question coming out of? Is it a problem of language? Is it a problem of concept? Is it a problem of making a mistake in their worldview? Where is that question coming from? What experiences? So looking under the question helps you to walk around. But I think there's some other ways that we can walk around and look at the question from other people's perspective. One would be listening to people. That sounds really obvious. Of course, you listen to people when you're in a conversation with them. But I think we all know what it's like to be in a conversation with someone who does most of the talking, don't we? And when they do let you get a word in edgewise, you can tell they're not really listening to what you're saying. They're just sort of waiting until you pause so that they can say the next thing that they want to say. And I think sometimes, as Christians, we have so much that we do want to say. Jesus has been so meaningful in our life, and we really want to communicate that to people. And that's not a bad thing, that's a very good thing. But if all we're thinking about in that conversation is what we want to say and how we can get out our next line, we're never going to really hear or be present to the other person and what they're saying back to us. And one of the things that Rick's music did for us this morning, didn't it, when he sang those songs from John Lennon and Sarah McLachlan, was took us into the world of the people that are singing that song. Not just to say, oh, those people out there, they don't believe in God, but to let you see the passion in the heart of those people. Where are these questions coming out of? Sarah McLachlan sang, "Dear God, I can't believe in you," almost as passionately as most of us sing, "Dear God, I do believe in you." Why? Where is that passion, that anger, that angst coming from in her worldview? It's really important that we're able to put ourselves in other people's perspectives and understand their worldviews. Listening is probably going to be one of the most important ways to do that. Asking questions, another one. Jesus was a master at this. Anytime someone came and threw a challenge at Jesus, he very rarely just gave them an answer right off, did he? Almost always, he asked a question back to the person that was challenging him. And that question helped to uncover a whole bunch of things. So when the man came to Jesus and said, you know, "Good teacher, what must I do to have eternal life?" Does anyone remember what Jesus said? Yeah, "Why do you call me good? There's no one good but God." He was uncovering an assumption in that person's question that he had asked. Why do you call me good? No one's good but God. Why are you asking me this question? He got at the real heart of what that person was trying to ask. What about when the people challenged Jesus about his authority? By what authority are you saying these things? What did Jesus ask back? Does anyone remember? He asked, "By what authority do you think John the Baptist did all these things," right? Why did he ask that question? Because he was uncovering something else, not an assumption, but actually a motive in this case for asking the question. They didn't want to respond whether John's authority came from heaven or came from earth because they were afraid of what the people would say. And Jesus uncovered the fact that they actually had no interest in the truth at all. Their real question was about power. And that one question Jesus asked back revealed the motive in their asking. The question wasn't about truth at all. It was about power. So asking questions can uncover a lot of things. It's very helpful. And lastly, taking the time to study and learn about other worldviews. Taking the time to study and learn about other worldviews. If you hadn't really taken the time to learn anything about Islam and you met with a Muslim person, then you might not realize what I just said about what Muslims understand when they hear the word Son of God. The only reason I know that is because I've talked to people who are Muslim and because I've read books that tell me that. So it does take a little bit of effort and a little bit of learning sometimes to realize what are the context to the people that I'm speaking. What is their worldview? How do they understand these things? And when you take the time to do that and learn a little bit about how other people think, you realize something. You realize that every single worldview that's out there has to answer the big questions of life. It's not just Christians who are on the stand having to provide perfect responses to every challenge that's thrown out. Every worldview has to answer or address in some way the fundamental questions that John mentioned last night: origin, meaning, morality, destiny. Every worldview has to say something about those basic questions because all human beings ask those questions. And if a worldview doesn't have very satisfactory answers for them, it's not going to be a very compelling worldview. But sometimes people haven't taken the time even to think through their own worldview and what are some of the implications of the worldview that they hold. And people just sometimes believe what feels good to them without really having thought through whether it makes sense with their first principles or their first basic beliefs. So sometimes, in walking around the question, you not only understand where the person's coming from, but I think you can help them understand a little bit better their own worldview sometimes. Maybe some of the implications of it they haven't thought through. For example, what if a person who doesn't believe in God at all asks you a question about suffering and evil in the world? And they think, if I'm going to become a Christian, this Christian has to give me an answer to this question. They may not have stopped to think about how their own worldview answers questions about suffering and evil. Actually, if there's no God and there's no purpose to the universe at all, then things just are what they are. How can you even call something evil? What does it mean to say something's evil? I think, in some ways, an atheist person has their own serious problem of evil and suffering. Because in their worldview, suffering is a normal, natural part of the universe and how human beings came to exist. How can you call it a problem at all? So unless you walk around and look at the question from the other person's worldview, sometimes you'll feel that you're the only one on the hook and forget to realize that other worldviews have the responsibility to answer some of the same questions. And lastly, last way to stay in the conversation, see from the perspective of the cross. See from the perspective that the Christian worldview offers to the question. And in a way, this is what instinctively we want to jump to first, right? Okay, here's the question. What's the Christian answer to the question? But I think you can see from what we've talked to before that it can be a mistake to go here at the very beginning because we may miss a lot of things that need to be clarified. But that doesn't relieve us of the responsibility of this part of the dialogue, of knowing your story very well. Paul talked last night about story answers. And I think what we realize is that answering questions is not just about knowing this slot machine answer to every question that comes our way, but it's about understanding the story of God and the world and how it makes sense of everything else. It's learning to live and breathe that story so that you can communicate it to other people in a way that makes sense. That you can translate the concepts into concepts of business, concepts of, you know, economics or culture or things that might not be specifically outlined in this verse in the Bible. But because you have the biblical worldview grounded, then you can live it and breathe it and translate it into every area of life. We're going to talk about that a little bit later too. But you'll never be able to do this. You'll never be able to speak from the Christian worldview unless you also live from the Christian worldview. And the most powerful apologetic that we can give is the one that we live with our lives. It gives credibility to what we say with our mouths. And there's this story that I love in the book of Acts, and Peter and John have healed this crippled man. I mean, God has healed this crippled man using Peter and John. And Peter and John are proclaiming that it's through God and through the risen Jesus that this has happened. And so the religious authorities arrest him. And when they come before the religious authorities and they speak with confidence and boldness, the response of the audience later is that they saw these were uneducated and ordinary men who obviously hadn't been educated, but they recognized that they had been with Jesus. And that's such a powerful thing that when people hear us speak, they can recognize that whether we have been with Jesus or not. And in some ways, even that takes a bit of the pressure off having to know every detailed answer to every question. Because if you've been with Jesus, if you live with Jesus, if you live out of this worldview, that's apparent to people. And the threat of questions doesn't become as strong anymore. Because the truth is that even someone as smart as Dr. Evans will tell you, if you ask him, that there are probably serious questions that he still asks about God and about faith, even though he studied and knows so much. How many people in this room don't have serious questions about God and faith? I didn't think anyone would raise their hands. So the truth is that even those of us who believe and call Jesus our Savior and Lord can still ask questions. And if what we communicate to the people on the outside is that, well, just come inside and every question will be answered, then questions will always be a barrier to them from belief in Jesus, because they'll think that the question that they ask that is somehow preventing them from stepping inside the faith, somehow preventing them or keeping them away from Jesus. But if they see that you ask the same question from inside, from belief in Jesus, then all of a sudden that question loses some of its power, doesn't it? They realize that question in and of itself does not have the power to keep me away from believing in Jesus. That question in and of itself loses its potency. It doesn't mean it's not important that we don't wrestle with it. But if someone can really believe in Jesus as strongly as you do and still ask a question, then, well, maybe it's not impossible for me to believe either. Three ways to stay in the conversation that I think are really important. Now, last night, we took down a bunch of questions. They're all up here on this whiteboard, but I've also done us a little favor in typing them into the PowerPoint. And you'll notice that when people ask questions, and even when we ask our own questions, they often fall into some categories. And so I've sort of grouped them according to certain categories. So we have questions about truth and reality. Is Jesus real? Why do you believe? How do you know? The validity of the Bible. Evolution and science. Why is there such a big universe and only such small people? And similarities of religions. Aren't all religions really the same anyways? These, in a way, they're questions about truth or reality. What's real? What's not real? How do we know? Questions about evidence. How do you know what you know to be true? And the reason I'm grouping them like this is that you'll find that when you go to look under the question and ask for the assumptions of the question, a lot of these questions, they share some common assumptions. Questions about truth and reality often share some common assumptions about what it means to know, about how you can prove things, about evidence, about faith. What do you think are some of the assumptions that people in our culture have when they ask questions about truth or reality or evidence? Yeah, they're assuming that you can know things at all. The rest of this session is going to be interactive, so put your thinking caps on, and you're going to help me go through these questions according to this framework that we've done. So what are some of the assumptions, maybe, that would lie under questions about truth or reality?
Are we supposed to be rational?
Yeah, are we supposed to be rational? I think some people assume that faith means being irrational, and somehow there's some other way to be rational, maybe by being a scientist or something like that. Is that sort of...
Are there any absolutes?
Someone was...
Something bigger than ourselves.
Something bigger than ourselves?
Are you supposed to ask them in the first place?
Sorry? Are you supposed to ask these questions in the first place? Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of assumptions that people make, particularly, about rationality and about evidence and about the relationship between those things to our beliefs. There's a lot of people in our culture, and there's a lot of people who are writing best-selling books in our culture right now, who would say that to have faith means to be irrational, that those are basically synonyms. Having faith means believing something without any evidence or reason to do so. And that being rational must mean what? How do you know something?
Prove it.
Yeah, prove it, preferably by science or some kind of hard evidence. So Christians, or anyone who believes in any of these things, they believe it because they're just taking a blind leap in the dark without any evidence. And then there are the rational people who have proof and evidence for their beliefs. Are you asking a question?
Yeah, I'm asking a question.
Why didn't Jesus answer the question, what is truth? Well, I think maybe the reason Jesus didn't answer the question is because he knew that there were things underlying even that question, perhaps assumptions. I think one reason is that Pilate didn't wait around to hear the answer to that question. And another reason is similar, actually, to what we're talking about right here, that people assume that truth is really about having the right answers to everything and having all of the arguments to back it up. And that faith is just about believing in the absence of evidence. But I think you'll realize, and John communicated this really well last night, that every single person that lives on the earth has faith. And they actually have a very fundamental faith. What do they believe is the nature of the universe? Is it here by accident? Is it here on purpose? Is there a God? Is there not a God? Most of those fundamental assumptions that we have, they can't be proven in the same way that you prove something in a lab on a Bunsen burner in a science lab. They don't have that kind of evidence for them, because they are the sort of assumptions that you have to make about the world before you can even understand science at all. You have to assume that there's such a thing as a world, that the world operates according to patterns and laws before you can even start to do scientific proof. And that's a faith that you have, that the universe is an ordered, rational place. If you don't assume that, then the concept of proof doesn't make any sense at all, does it?
When it comes to proof, can't we use our own lives of earth and where Jesus has brought us now?
I think the question was, when it comes to proof, can't we use our own lives and living proof? And I think that's part of what I was saying earlier about people being able to see that we've been with Jesus. But sometimes people are going to want something more than that too. And the reason being is that there's going to be other people in their life that are very good, compelling people who may make different claims about truth or reality than you do. And so in that case, people will end up saying, well, whose story is better? And they'll end up picking or choosing which person they like better. And if you don't have any other things to talk about, you know, why Jesus as opposed to this, then people are just sort of left to pick and choose between different people's stories. So stories are very important, but they're really, really important to confirm true things. And so the people still might want to ask the question, well, why do you believe it to be true? Does that make sense?
You have your own light of where you were in darkness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, yeah.
And then being transformed into this new man, off a drug, living for God, being full of the Holy Spirit, and just giving Him glory every day, praising Him. And just the transformation process of where you were and now where He's brought you.
Yes,
yeah. I think enough proof for people to see that, okay, He was here, and look at the power of God that moved Him over here.
It's very compelling. Personal stories and testimonies are very... they can be very, very compelling. And every one of us in this room hopefully has a personal testimony of our experience with Jesus that we can share with people. But at the same time right now, we are also talking about very specific questions that people might ask then. Okay, I'm just going to finish this thought, okay? And then if you want to talk to me afterwards, we can work through it. But I think that what you're saying is very, very important. I also think that people will ask you, after that, some people will ask you, well, why should I believe that to be true? That might be your experience, but that's not been my experience. And so a way to keep the conversation going then is maybe to be able to unpack some of the assumptions about why they don't have the same experience or why they don't understand that experience quite the same way that you understand that experience. So unpacking assumptions about evidence and reality is really important. And one of the reasons is because we all have faith. We all have a fundamental faith about the universe and about God before we have evidence. And another assumption that people have is that faith doesn't have evidence to back it up. But as you heard from Dr. Evans, and as you can read in a lot of good books written by a lot of good people, there is a lot of evidence and there is a lot of good reason to believe in God. But those reasons might not be the same kind of reasons that you have to prove whether there's a planet Mars or not. Why? Because the planet Mars is just something that may or may not exist in the universe. But a belief in God is a belief in the very foundations of the universe. God is not a part of the universe that you can, you know, put in a test tube. But when you believe in God, the whole universe starts to make sense in a way that it doesn't otherwise. C.S. Lewis said a really great quote one time. He said, "I believe in God the same way I believe that the sun has risen, not because I see it, but because by its light I see everything else." Do you see the difference? Not because you see it, but because by its light you see everything else. And I think the kinds of reasons sometimes that we need to talk about with God are not, here's the, you know, exact hard scientific proof why God exists, but take a look at a world that has a God, as opposed to a worldview that doesn't believe in a God, and see which one makes more sense of our experience, makes more sense of our consciences and our moral feelings about the world, which one makes more sense of love, which one makes more sense of relationships. And again, I'm not going to spend too much time because John gave a great, compelling talk about that last night. So we don't have time to go through every one of these questions today, but questions about truth and reality often rely on fundamental assumptions about what faith means and what evidence means. And the assumption that faith and evidence are two opposite things is a faulty assumption that you need to pick apart with people. Everyone has faith that they can't prove the very basic things that they believe. But once you've accepted those worldviews, which worldview makes more sense of the world that we live in? And then when it comes to very specific questions, you know, the validity of the Bible, you heard some great stuff from Craig Evans. There's specific sources that you can go to, that you can point people to, that will help out. Secondly, a group of questions that we talked through was moral challenges to God. Why does God allow suffering? Why did God create people if he knew they'd sin? Why did God create war? I'm a good person, shouldn't I go to heaven? How can God send billions of people to hell? Those are literal word-for-word questions that were asked last night. Every single one of them is a moral challenge to God. Do you see how they're moral challenges to God? Every one of those questions in some way is saying, God has done something, or you're claiming that God has done something, and I'm claiming that God shouldn't have done that. That that's not a right way that a God would act. That's a moral claim. That's a moral challenge to God, that the way that God acts, the way that your Christians are claiming that God acts, is immoral. Now, there's a fundamental assumption in any claim like that. Before we get to the specifics of the questions, which I think have other assumptions that need to be unpacked, there's a fundamental assumption in any claim that's a moral challenge to God. What's that assumption?
They put themselves in the place of God as being higher in moral character than God.
Yeah, they're assuming that they're in a position to make a moral judgment on God. Now, what's wrong with that assumption?
They're telling God what to do.
They're telling God what to do.
It's sort of
So there's sometimes an inconsistency in how we want rules to be applied to other people and how we want them to be applied to us. And I think that's quite clear. We look out at the world and we say, you know, why aren't the police harder on all the crime out there? But when you get pulled over for speeding, what's your reaction? Yes.
People are trying to conform God to their own inner morals.
Yeah, people are trying to conform God to their own inner morals. And actually, you've, I think, hit on an even more basic assumption. People are assuming that there is such a thing as morals. There is such a thing as real morals and real right and wrong. And supposedly, that is so clear what the right and wrong is that we know it enough to say to God that he's wrong. Now, where would a person like that get their idea of what is right and what is wrong? Where does that come from? Maybe experiences, their culture, their opinions.
Mm-hmm. At some point.
Intuitions. You're saying that there's this assumption that there's a moral law, and I think you're right, but I don't think most people ever get that far in their thinking, do they? Most people actually don't assume, they don't realize they've assumed that, because they never get past the TV, or the opinion, or the thing they heard from their neighbor, or wherever it happens that they get their moral views. They never take the next step back and say, well, why is that the case? What does it mean for something to be right or something to be wrong? Where does that come from? What must be true of the world in order for some things to be right and some things to be wrong? And I think when we really think about it, we realize that you can't possibly know whether something's right or wrong or good or bad unless you know what it's for. And I've given this example before. How do you know if a fire truck is a good fire truck or a bad fire truck? Does it put out fires? Exactly. You got to know what it's for to know if it's right or wrong. How do you know if a race car is a good or bad race car? If it wins, if it goes fast. Now, unless you knew what those things were for and you just had a race car and a fire truck in front of you, how would you evaluate if it was good or bad? You can't say that a fire truck's a good fire truck because it goes fast. It has to do what it's supposed to do. It has to put out fires. And you can't know what things are for. You can't know if things are good or bad unless you know what they're for. You can't know what things are for if things aren't for anything. If things weren't designed with a purpose, if things weren't designed for a reason, then you can't know what they're for. So how can you know if they're good or bad? And that's where I think a lot of people in our culture make a huge mistake, because they've assumed that the world's designed for nothing, that there is no purpose behind it, that we're not made for any reason, and then they want to go making moral judgments about what's right and what's wrong and what's good and what's bad. Where does that come from? Science can only describe things. It can tell us the measurements of a fire truck. It can tell us its projection rate. It can tell us all these things. But unless we know that it was designed by human beings to put out fires, you can't make a value judgment about whether it's good or bad. And it's the same thing when we try to make moral judgments. Unless you understand that the world was designed and created for a purpose, then you can't really understand whether something is good or whether something's bad. Now, I think a lot of these assumptions still have more assumptions underneath them that we're going to get to. But we only have a few minutes left. I'm going to give you the last category. And then what I'd like us to do is to go into some groups. And we're going to talk through some of these questions according to the framework that I've just given you. The last group is questions about logic of Christian beliefs. Why didn't Jesus speak about significant moral issues that are divisive? This one was asked to me after the thing last night. And people ask this question a lot. Well, Jesus didn't say anything about abortion or homosexuality or slavery or some of these moral issues that we feel strongly about and are very controversial in our day and age. Well, why didn't, if Jesus was supposed to be this great teacher, why didn't he tell us more clearly about those things? Can predestination and free will be reconciled? Why talk to God if he knows everything? Why was there a tree in the garden? We're going to go into groups. And what I want you to do with these questions, you can pick, we're not going to get through all the questions, so you can pick which questions you want to address in your group. What I'd like you to do is go through them. Look under the question. Ask, what are some of the assumptions this person is making in asking this question? What are some of the assumptions? Secondly, walk around the question. Ask, what would another worldview, probably the most common worldview in our culture, would be a naturalist worldview. In other words, a worldview that believes there is no God, no purpose for the universe, and human beings are sort of left to figure out life on their own. I think that would be the most common worldview that offers challenges to Christian faith. There's also, very common, would be a pluralist worldview that sort of thinks we don't really know ultimately what the universe is, but everyone sort of claims about the universe are equally good and equally reliable. So think about those two worldviews and how they would answer some of these questions according to their own worldview. It might not be the exact same words. In other words, you know, they might not have to answer why there was there a tree in the Garden of Eden, because they don't believe in the Garden of Eden. But they still have to answer questions about evil, don't they, according to their own worldview. And I think that's what the heart of that question is getting at. So sometimes take a step back and say, what's this question really about? How would the other worldview address it? And lastly, what does the Christian perspective offer to this question? What unique things about the Bible or the Christian worldview, what do they have to say to this question? Some of us are going to be around, so we can maybe join in your groups a little bit, John and Rick and Paul and even Craig if he wants to maybe help guide some of the discussion, or if you have any questions or anything like that. So get in groups, maybe 5 or 6 people in a group, and you can spread out a little bit around the room and pick the questions that you want to address. Look under, walk around, see from. Yeah, we got about